Lonnie, I know your mother died when you were young, and this had a huge impact on the direction your life has taken since then. Can you tell us about your mother's death?
Yeah, it really informed the rest of my life, I think. And for that, I'm grateful. But when I was 13 years old, my mother had an illness for quite some time. And in my family, as I think it's common in many families at that time in the 60s, no one talked about her illness. And so it should not have been unexpected that she died. But it felt as though the rug was pulled out from under us. She was there one day and gone the next, taken to the hospital. And I was not able to see her in the hospital. I wasn't able to say goodbye. And she was dead 2 days later. And my father did the best job that he could. But there was no information as to how she died, why she died, the circumstances surrounding her death. And so, in the absence of information, I filled in the blanks. As a 13-year-old, I filled in the blanks, and my fantasy of how she died and why she died was worse than the reality. And
How did you fill in those blanks? What did you think happened?
oh, well, she was there one day and gone the next. And I was a typical 13-year-old trying, to find my own independence in my own way. And so, probably a week before she died, I clearly remember. I can close my eyes and still see it and feel it. She was at the kitchen sink, and I was passing through the kitchen. She turned around and she said to me, "Lonnie, I love you so much." And I just kind of rolled my eyes, as a 13-year-old would, and just kept walking. And so a week later, when she died, in my mind, I made up a story that she didn't fight to live because she didn't think that her own daughter loved her. And I lived with that guilt and regret and remorse on top of the grief for years and years and years. And she died in the hospital, and no one told me how she died. And for
So even though she had died, I mean, your father came home, your other relatives came home to tell you this
Yes.
shattering news, they didn't explain what happened?
No, they didn't. No. I believe that they thought they were trying to protect a child. Too much information would have been traumatizing, perhaps. I know they meant well, but it wasn't helpful. And so I had all these fantasies. I also believed that my mother died alone on the operating table. And it was 15 years later that my father made some mention of being with her as her eyes rolled back in her head and her heart stopped. And my reaction was anger. Because I said to him, "Do you understand that for all these years I had this horrible image of my mother dying alone? And had I known that you were with her holding her hand, it would have been such a gentler death. It would have been so much better for me to imagine that." So I'm so passionate about helping families and especially, children. Guiding families to share information appropriately to the age of a child, but really giving information, having conversations, answering all the questions that are asked, and repeating this over and over as a child accommodates the reality that a loved one has died. And it takes a long time. It takes a long time for an adult to accept the reality of death.
So going back to your mother's death, so if you could rewind the clock and do it differently, how do you wish your mother's death had been handled?
Oh, well, I wish that after my mother had been taken to the hospital that I was taken in. I wish that another adult, my father perhaps, or my grandparents had taken me in to be at my mother's bedside, whether she was conscious or not, but so that I could have told her I loved her or I could have said goodbye. I wish that they had given me information about the illness she had and that it was expected that she would die. So that I had time to just time to get used to that fact, to ask some questions, but to, for lack of a better term, finish some business with her. And I wish that I had been been there holding her hand. And then after she died, I wish that people had asked me questions. What are you thinking? What do you believe? What are you feeling? And just had really been a presence through my grief. But I felt very, very alone.
Well, and then it's striking, of course, that you since have gone into, I mean, you've devoted your whole life basically to working with people who are dying. I mean, both those who are actively dying and also those who have been left behind, who are grieving. I mean, that's what you've devoted your career to.
And hence the title of my book, that we don't have to be alone. We don't have to be alone in our dying, and we don't have to be alone in our grief. And when we're not, it makes a difference.
Well, then I know you were very involved years later when your father died. I mean, as he was approaching death, it sounds like you and he talked a lot about it.
Yes, I really spent the rest of my life learning everything that I could about death and dying and grief. And I vowed, no matter where I was, that I would drop everything if my father became ill. And it happened exactly that way. I was living and working in Virginia, and my father was in Hawaii. And I got a call from him saying that it wasn't pneumonia that he thought he had. In fact, it was late stage lung cancer. And so I closed my practice and I closed my university class and I flew right home and told my husband that I hoped that I would be gone for at least 6 months to care for him. Meaning I hoped that I'd had that much time with my father. And I flew home to be his primary caregiver. And we began talking about everything. I laid it on the table as though nothing was off limits. And I asked him very direct questions such as, where do you want to be? Who do you want to be with you? Who do you not want to be with you? Even what do you want to be looking at? What do you want to be listening to? What do you want to be smelling? And let's make a bucket list. We don't know how much time you have left, but let's hope for the best, but assume the worst. And let's make this quality time. Let's make this the best time of your life. Let's make it intimate. Let's make it rich. Let's make it authentic.
Were those hard conversations to have?
Not for me, they weren't.
What about for your dad?
No, actually, you know, and my experience with people at the end of life is that they are so hungry for someone to start the conversation. They want to talk about it, but most of them feel alone with the reality of what's really going on. In other words, there's a big elephant in the room and everyone is walking around it. So my father did. We did make that bucket list, and we gave him the end of his life that he asked for. But had we not, you know, had I not asked those questions, I would have been shooting in the dark and making assumptions, perhaps living out my dreams of the end of life rather than his. So it really was an opportunity for him to talk to me about his values and his wishes and his dreams and what he cared most about.
So the lesson here is communication, that we have to talk about death. We have to talk about this. We have to have the conversation that probably many of us are more scared of than any other kind of conversation we can have. And you're saying it's not just talking with people who are getting ready to die. You're saying we got to talk to our children about it, too.
I have been talking to my daughter since the time she was 5 years old about this, so that it is very, you know, it's just part of our daily language. And I think that that's an important part, too, is that we have to give children and we have to give people language to talk about this. You know, as we age, as we go into an illness, as we begin our dying, it is like going into a foreign country that we have not been to before. And we do need language. We need rituals. We need guides. And our culture doesn't provide that very well. And even, you know, top down, I'm talking about physicians have a very difficult time having these conversations with their patients. So it's not surprising that family members would also have a difficult time.
So how did you talk with your daughter? And you're saying you started talking with her when she was five? You started talking about death with her?
Well, I'm just interested in the subject. So I wonder out loud about a lot of things. And, you know, we're sitting around the dinner table and I'll just talk about, in the same way that I sit around our dinner table and ask what was the best part of your day and what was the challenging part of your day, those open-ended questions, I'll ask about, you know, when your pet died. So by the time she was, you know, five and a pet or a fish died, you know, we would have conversations about that. And would you want to have a funeral service for your fish? And how do you think you'd do that? And where would you like to bury it? Or how would you like to bury this fish? And what's the thing you're going to remember most about the fish? So from an early time, from an early age, I think we can introduce our children to the cycle of life so that they're not afraid of it, so that they can expect it, they can feel prepared. And as we do this, see, we're giving them language, we're giving them a way to be with it, but we're giving them competency, we're building competency, and we're building confidence so that later on in life, they can lean into this as an opportunity.
Well, you're also talking about normalizing death in a way. I mean,
absolutely.
Saying this is not something that sort of is outside of our experience. I mean, this is going to happen to all of us.
Right. And what I see with children is that children do not fear death or dying. And I work with a lot of children who are dying. They don't fear dying unless they are taught to fear it. And of course, they pick up on adults' fears, on our body language. They pick on what we don't talk about, you see. They learn, oh, don't go there. That's taboo. Generally, that's what our culture feels about death and dying.
And what do you think your daughter took away from those conversations?
Oh, ease. So that even now later, she's a, you know, 32-year-old woman in a very dangerous job on the ocean. And
what does she do?
She's an officer in the Coast Guard, and she is the commanding officer of a ship. And she's in charge of a number of many people's lives. And she's out there on the high seas. And so I asked her one day, if you could have your perfect death, and we know we're all going to die, but if you could choose your perfect death, what would it be? And she said to me without, you know, hesitation, oh, I'd prefer to drown.
Wow. And that's supposed to be one of the worst kinds of death, isn't it?
Well, that's an assumption. And people who have near-death experiences reports it to be a different, very peaceful experience. But she said she'd like to drown. So as a mother of a woman who spends probably at least 50% of her life on the ocean, recreationally also, can you imagine, as a mother, how my grief will be different if she were to drown?
Yeah.
Yes, very different, my grief. And so that's a gift. The information, I asked the question, we had a conversation, and she gave me the gift of her values, you see? And it'll make a difference. I know more about her, you know? And as we have conversations at the end about the end of life, our values do come out.
And you're talking this is really about developing your relationship. In other words, it's not just helping her talk about how she's going to deal with death later on. I mean, you might change in the process
as well. We all win. So that at the end of when my father did die, because we had these conversations, my grief was so different than the grief I felt after my mother's death. What I said to myself after my father's death was, I gave him what he wanted. Not only did I give him the death that he wanted, I gave him the life that he wanted right up to the moment of his death. And I did not have the regret. I did not have the remorse. Of course, I had grief. I missed him. I still miss him. But I feel full. I feel grateful. I feel as though the experience was as much for me as it was for him.
And I'm sure that you still have a relationship with him.
I mean,
and which probably changed in some ways, you know, in response to those final months of being
yes,
with him.
Yes, Yes, yes. And because I had those conversations, my relationship was different than my siblings who didn't or couldn't. And my grief is different. So everybody wins when we have these conversations.
Okay, let's talk about, let's say, adults who feel like they need to have this conversation with their aging mm-hmm. parents. What if their parents mm-hmm. don't want to talk about death?
I think that there are ways, actually, that comes up a lot in my hospice work. And I go into families and I coach the adult primary caregivers. And what I usually recommend is that they use themselves first. So I want to be very respectful of my elderly parent if this isn't a conversation that they want to have. But it may not be that they don't want to have it. It may be that they don't know how to have it. So I begin with myself, and I'll go in and I'll say, I'll coach this adult who doesn't know how to have a conversation, and I'll say, we're not going to talk about your elderly mother. We're going to talk about yourself. So begin with yourself. Mom, you know, the other day, my 60-year-old friend died suddenly, and it occurred to me that I had never told my husband how I wanted to be buried or what I cared about. And so I've started having this conversation with my husband, and I want you to know that I want to be cremated, and I want my ashes to be spread out in the water, and I want just a small private memorial service. And this is what I hope you remember. So, again, I'm just talking about myself, and I'm using language, and I'm modeling that conversation. And then at the end of this conversation, and by the way, we don't have just one conversation. We go back to it, little pieces. But at the end of this conversation, then I might say to this mother, you know, and Mom, I don't think I know what you really care about. And I want to follow your wishes, but I don't want to guess. And I wonder if, as a gift to me, you would tell me what you care about most. So that's the way I'd begin that conversation. I would talk about me, and then I would just invite her to answer one or two questions.
And your experience is that usually that opens the mm-hmm. door to a, mm-hmm. a meaningful conversation.
Mm-hmm. Yes, because I've begun with myself to be vulnerable.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you said that one of the conversations you have, one of the things you asked your own father is, how would you like to die?
Mm-hmm.
I would think that a lot of people might not really have an answer to that, or they might have kind of an answer in the abstract when they're still healthy. But then, you know, once they start becoming very frail, I mean, their thinking might change.
Yes. Yes. And so one of the things that we need is education. And most people do not have education about what CPR looks like, or they have assumptions about artificial nutrition or feeding tubes, or what it feels like if someone is not hydrated at the end of life. So we need to give them information about those parts of the end of life or options at the end of life so that they can make more informed decisions. But the conversations are not all about, information. We really have to talk emotionally about what all of this means. And the more that we do that, the more we prevent suffering, and not just the physical suffering, but the emotional suffering, and there is more peace. So we can make plans for ahead of death, and we can know what we're talking about. It can be abstract, but we can give some statistics. So, for instance, I might say to my father, and now he had end-stage lung cancer, and they didn't find it until the end. But even before that, we could have said, Dad, if you have Alzheimer's and you can't take care of yourself, do you know what you would want done? Or would you like someone to perform CPR on you if you knew that you were still going to die in 3 months. So we had those kinds of conversations, and he was very clear. He was at home with hospice care, and he was very clear that he did not want the ambulance to be called. He wanted to die at home. So, you know, I think we can know I don't want to die in the hospital. I want to die at home. In fact, I think the statistics are that 80% of people want to die at home, and yet 80% of people die in the hospital.
But that is so tough. I mean, yes, you might sort of think that in the abstract, but then, okay, you know, there is this procedure that would seem to be able to save you right now. And, you know, who knows how long you might live.
Yes, except that what most people don't know about CPR is that I believe only 12% of the time it's successful. And if you're elderly and frail, CPR will, you know, break your bones, crack your ribs, and it is very invasive. So if I knew that I had a 12% chance of being successfully resuscitated, and I had end stage cancer and was probably going to die in a month anyway, would I want that done? I probably wouldn't want that done if I really had come to peace with my relationships, I had said my goodbyes, and I was in pain. I would, you know, if I had all of that information, I may make a different decision.
Yeah. Now, there's another kind of conversation as well, and that's with people who are dying. I mean, who are in their final weeks, maybe final days. And I know you've talked with thousands, literally thousands of people, and you've been at the bedside hundreds of times at the moment of death. I mean, you worked in hospice and other places.
Yes.
What are those conversations like?
Rich. They're very rich. Those conversations don't have the they're not superficial conversations. They really get down to pretty much the five things that people need to say at the end of life, which is thank you and I love you, and those are the things that I hear at the end of life, but not the petty little details. At the end of life, also, people have conversations with deceased loved ones who they report are in the room with them. And one of the things that I try to do with families is to encourage them to validate that experience. Those of us who are with the dying person don't see those that the patient reports are there. But it's a very different experience when we validate it. And I can hear the dying person sigh as though, you know, someone believes me. And it's not uncommon that soon afterward they do let go and die.
So these are common, and these kinds of
very
deathbed
common
visions.
Yeah, pre-death visions are very, very common. And my response to a person who says, you know, Johnny's in the room. Johnny's here. And I might say, and who's Johnny? And the woman says, oh, my husband. My response is, well, of course he's here. Where else would he be? Whereas other people might say, oh, you know, hush, hush, it's just the medication, you're hallucinating. Why would we take that comfort away from someone?
Yeah. I mean, of course, it raises the question of whether Johnny really is there.
It doesn't matter. Doesn't matter. This woman has the experience that she is being companioned, that someone is there to, is waiting for her to guide her. And it isn't for me to say she's wrong. It is her experience, and in the moment, it comforts her. Why would we take that away?
What do you think, for people who are dying, what are their biggest fears, or their biggest worries, do you think?
In my experience, dying person's greatest fear is, will my loved one be okay? And some of that, too, is I hear from the dying, do they know that I haven't given up? In other words, my death is not a failure. My death is not a punishment. Death is normal, but I don't want my loved ones to think that I have abandoned them, I'm leaving them, or I haven't worked or fought hard enough.
That's interesting. I mean, that's interesting because I guess I might have guessed that they would be most worried about their own death. I mean, what's going to happen? You know, that end stage, the pain that might be involved, is it the end? You're saying that's actually more concerned about how other people are going to respond to their death.
Yes. Yes. That's what I hear most often. And remember that at the end of life, we have so many options with palliative or comfort care and hospice intervention. People do not have to die in pain. If we know that someone is terminal, we can give them comfort measures and medications so that they are not in pain. So I don't hear a lot of people concerned with pain. Most people, I would say, really a majority are ready to go, ready to let go, but they're concerned as to whether their loved ones are going to be okay. You know, I don't want you to grieve for me. I want you to be able to go on, those kinds of things. And so as family members, one of the things that I coach is for them to be specific and to let them know, Dad, I'm going to be okay. This is how I'm going to be okay. Also, Dad, this is what I'm going to remember of you. You have a legacy. You'll always be in my heart. You know, one of the things I told my dad was, I'm going to continue to take you on my walk on Kailua Beach. Yeah. So you'll always be with me. And this is what I'll remember about you, Dad. And this is how I'll see you in my world. And this is how I will continue to be your daughter. So very specific ways to let him know that, he will still be my father. I will still daughter him, and he'll still be in my world.
And I would think that would be so important. I mean, the person who's dying wants to know that their life has had meaning
and they will not be forgotten. And they will not be forgotten. Yes.
What about people with dementia? Any thoughts on those kinds of conversations?
Yes, I have lots of thoughts about people with dementia and Alzheimer's. I treat them as though all of them are still here. One of the things I know is that our last sense to go is hearing, and so I speak to them right up to the end. One of the things I coach families, so someone with dementia, yes, we may have to repeat something over and over and over. So what? Why not? I'm your daughter. I'm your daughter. I'm your daughter. I'm reminded of a woman that I ran into recently who was on the way to her mother. And the mother had Alzheimer's. And I asked her what I think is one of the most important questions when someone is doing this work or grieving, which is, what is the hardest part? So I asked this daughter, what is the hardest part about going to visit your mom with Alzheimer's? And she started to cry and said, well, she doesn't know who I am, and I don't know if I'm making a difference. And I said, what is your goal? And she said, well, to give my mother comfort and to love her. And I said, then does it matter whether she knows who it is that's loving her and giving her comfort? In other words, can't you accomplish your goal whether she knows you are her daughter or not? And that changed her ability to, really be present in a very patient way with her mother.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, a lot of it is, I mean, the hard part in a way is to be there for your dying loved one and not make it about yourself.
Right. To be fully present. To be fully present to their needs and not your own agenda. And, of course, a caregiver does have their own needs. But there's a time for that, and there are ways to attend to your own needs.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, I know there's another piece of this story for you personally. And years ago, you had a near-death experience.
I did.
Can you tell us what happened?
Mm-hmm. I was 28 years old and had a 2-year-old precious baby and was happily married. And it was just an accident. I was in a dentist chair and went into anaphylactic shock from the laughing gas, nitrous oxide. I don't think it was anyone's fault. And one minute I was in lying back in the dentist chair, and the next minute I knew, I was aware that I was up in the corner of the ceiling of the room. And no pain, no fear, no anxiety, but observing the dentist who was frantic, and I was trying to communicate with the dentist that I was okay. The next thing I knew, I was going into a tunnel, and my mother was at the entrance of the tunnel with her arms open wide. I hadn't seen my mother in 15 years. She'd been dead for 15 years. But I knew it was my mother, as though I was just falling right into her arms. And it was a reunion, and it was a healing. It was a moment of, you know, forgiving myself for all of the things I had believed. And we communicated telepathically. And I knew that she had always been with me. I knew that she knew all the details of my life that I so badly, you know, wanted to tell her every single day that she was gone. And there was just such peace. And the next thing I knew, I was being drawn to a point of light at the end of a tunnel. And it still surprises me that I would, you know, let go of my mother. But I couldn't do anything but go towards this light. And I went through this tunnel with beautiful, beautiful music, and beautiful, almost opalescent blue. That was a color in the tunnel, and went toward this light. And then I was in front of the light, and then the light was all around me. And then I was inside the light, almost as though the light and I were one. And I knew in every fiber of whatever I was, that I was loved and forgiven beyond anything I'd ever experienced or have since. And I wanted to stay there. And all was well. And the light communicated to me again telepathically, but I felt it. And I heard, "You have to go back." And with all of me, I yelled, "No." And again, the light said, "You have to go back. You have work to do." And again, I yelled, "No." And the next thing I knew, I was coming back through the tunnel, and regained consciousness back in the dentist chair. And I didn't tell that story. I didn't tell anyone for about 5 years because I didn't think anyone would understand. And
you didn't even tell your husband?
Oh, my husband knew. Yes. When I came home, my husband looked at me and knew something had changed. Hmm. But I thought, you know, I'd be banned from the PTA. I mean, what kind of mother doesn't want to come back to her child? And it wasn't that I didn't want to come back to my child. It wasn't that I didn't want to come back to my husband and my life. It was that, I wanted to stay in that love. And I think that gives me such peace and an ability to be with people who are dying, because I know it's all okay. I really know it's all okay.
Did you almost die in the dentist chair?
Yes, I was gone for about 10 minutes.
Hmm.
Yeah.
So touch and go there. I mean, just from a medical perspective.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah.
So it sounds like that experience had a profound impact on you later years.
It still does. Yeah. Great peace.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, from a more spiritual perspective, so what do you make of that? I mean, are you convinced there is an afterlife?
I am convinced that I experienced that consciousness continues, that there is no separation, that we are always connected with loved ones, and that there is an order rather than a chaos to life and death, and that love really is the governing force through all of it.
Do you think a lot about your own death?
Oh, I do. I try to live every day as though it's my last. Yeah. If I walk out of here today, the people that I love know that I love them. They know exactly what my wishes are. And I hope that I don't have any unfinished business. It's a full life.
And does the idea of dying scare you?
No, not at all.
Not at all?
Not at all. No, I'm not saying that I would like to go through pain, but the idea of death, I don't, it's not an end. It's a graduation.
Ulani, this has been a gift to talk with you. Thank you.
Thank you.